Moving on to Chafdeis Amud Beis, four lines from the bottom. We learned in the Mishnah that they used to use signal torches to inform everybody when Beis Din had declared Rosh Chodesh, and that way, of course, news could get to Bavel and to other places a lot faster than when they had to send Shluchim. But then we said the Kusim messed things up, and they started lighting them at the wrong time, and therefore they had to start sending out Shluchim instead. So now let's talk about when they did that. Tana Rabbanan, Ein Masi Masuos Ela Al Chodesh Shnira Bezmanu L'Kadshei. They would only do these masuos, these torches, only when the new moon had been visible in its time, meaning on the night after the 29th, L'Kadshei, and then they would inform them with the torches that it was a 29-day month and it was one day Rosh Chodesh. The Ein Masi Masi, and when would they light the torches? La'or iburay, the night before the ibur, meaning the night before what would have been the second day of Rosh Chodesh if it had been a 2-day Rosh Chodesh. In other words, let's say, for example, that the moon was visible Tuesday night, and let's say the 29th of the month was on Tuesday. The moon was visible Tuesday night. So the next day, Wednesday, Adim came to Beis Din and told them, and Beis Din was Mekadesh the Chodesh, and they said that there's one day Rosh Chodesh on Wednesday. Wednesday night, then, is when they would light the torches to inform everybody that there was only one day Rosh Chodesh. Lememra, which is to say, Da'achoser Abdinen, Amolei Le'Abdinen, which is to say, therefore, we only do it for a Chodesh Choser if there's a Chodesh Molei, had it been that the moon was not visible in that scenario Tuesday night, and therefore that they had to be Mekadesh. Therefore that Rosh Chodesh was Wednesday and Thursday, then they would not light the torches on Wednesday night or on Thursday night. So my timer, why not? Because if they did it for both kinds of month, both Molei and Chaser, then you would have a problem when Rosh Chodesh, following a Chaser month, comes out on Erev Shabbos, like this upcoming Rosh Chodesh now, which is going to be. We have Cheshvan, we're in Cheshvan now. Cheshvan, this is Nikva this year, that it has 29 days, and Rosh Chodesh is one day Friday. So when would we be? Now, we have to consider like this. They obviously can't do the torches on the night of Rosh Chodesh itself, because it's very rare that Beis Din will have been Mekadesh the Chodesh by that time. It could conceivably happen, like we talked about previously, that the moon is visible at the very end of the day on the 29th, and Beis Din themselves has a chance to see it, or there are Edim right there adjacent to Beis Din, and they're able to rush in, and Beis Din is able to cross-examine them and declare Rosh Chodesh, but that would be very rare. Most of the time, by the time the moon is visible, it's already after Shkia, and we're going to learn later on that you can't be Mekadesh the Chodesh at night. So the only thing they can do is wait for the next morning, which is the morning of the 30th, and be Mekadesh at then. So they can't have done the torches the night before, because most of the time Beis Din will have not been Mekadesh the Chodesh yet. They can't do them during the day, because torches are not going to be visible from a distance during the day. Necessarily, they have to do them at night. So again, they're doing them the night after Rosh Chodesh. But now, again, the question is, why are we doing it only for a Chodesh Chaser and not for a 2-day Rosh Chodesh, for a Chodesh Molei? So Rav Zeira is saying, because let's consider what happens if Rosh Chodesh, after a 29-day month, comes out on Erev Shabbos, like this upcoming one. Amos Abdi, when would they have to do the torches? Necessarily, again, they can't do them Thursday night, because Beis Din wasn't Mekadesh the Chodesh yet. They can't do it Friday night, because it's Shabbos. Necessarily, Amos Abdi, when would they have to do the torches? Ba'apokei Shabbos. They would have to do it Motzei Shabbos. Now, nami amolei. Now, if you're going to tell me that they do also for a chodesh molei, then they're going to get confused. The people in the gola where you're sending these messages to are not going to know. Amri, they're going to say, is it high chosahu? Is it the previous month was 29 days? And the only reason they didn't do it Friday night is because you couldn't, because it was Shabbos. Or maybe it was a 30-day month, it was Manei Avdu, and now they're doing it Matzah Shabbos, which is exactly the right time to do it. If you did it for a Chodesh Molei as well, then when would you be doing it? Again, the night after Rosh Chodesh was declared. Rosh Chodesh having been declared on Shabbos in that scenario, because the moon wasn't visible on Thursday night. So therefore, of necessity, therefore Rosh Chodesh is on Shabbos. So then the torches are on Matzah Shabbos, which is exactly the right time. So they would have no way of knowing, and therefore we can't do it for a Chodesh Chaser or or Mully. We have to do it. We have to do it for we can only do it for one or the other. Which the Gemara is going to ask
Before they had a fixed calendar, were they doing using these systems? Everyone in Chutz La'aretz was couldn't celebrate Rosh Chodesh because it was too late when they got the signal.
Well, fine. We're going to talk about that in a minute in the Gemara. They would keep it misafik. They would keep it to be on the safe side in a similar way to we keep 2 days of Yom Tov to be on the safe side. But wait, we're going to get to that. We're going to get to that in a few lines. Yeah, what they would do. But in any case, the point is. So they couldn't do it for both. It's an interesting point that occurred to me. Why didn't they make it that, for example, there would be a different, let's say, a different pattern of signaling for whether it was in time or whether it was a day late, and then they would be able to do it for both. They could have done like a form of Morse code for one versus the other, but they didn't. We said in the mission they were just molekul maybe malo murdered. They just waved it back and forth and up and down. Okay. So the Gemara asked, "Vela evid bein a mole or bein a choser?" Fine. Still, why can't we do it for both a chodesh mole and a chodesh choser? The chimikla rosh chodesh be'erev Shabbos loyla evid klal. So what'll happen when you have a kvius like this upcoming rosh chodesh, where rosh chodesh is on Friday? Then fine that where it was a chodesh choser and rosh chodesh is on Friday. Fine, loyla evid klal. In that one case, we won't do the tortures at all. Now, on the other hand, in such a case, we won't do the torches Matzoi Shabbos either. But since usually va'avdinin amole, usually we do for a chodesh mole as well, hypothetically, if we did for both. So if this one time we leave them out altogether, meida yadi dechosehu, automatically they're going to know it's a chodesh choser. Because they're going to realize to themselves, we would have, if it was a chodesh choser, it would have been Friday night. Well, we know they can't do it Friday night. So instead, it's a chodesh mole, and they're doing it motzei Shabbos. And so instead, they're doing it motzei Shabbos. They're going to know that So what is it? So if we did it motzei Shabbos, you're right. They would think maybe it was a chodesh mole. What we'll do is we won't do it motzei Shabbos either. That will make them realize, you know what? Obviously, then it must have been a chodesh choser, and they couldn't have done it Friday night. The answer is afilu hochi ik osu l'miti. Even so, if we did that, there could still be the possibility of confusion. Amri, because they might think, "Hi Molehu, it was a Chodesh Mole, so Rosh Chodesh was in fact on Shabbos." V'hai delay Avdi, I didn't do the torches Motzei Shabbos when they should have. Fine, it happens. It's Nusi who did Nusi. It happened that they became drunk. They drank too much on Shabbos, and then Motzei Shabbos they weren't able to do the torches. So they're not necessarily going to know. Because of the absence of torches on Matzoi Shabbos, that necessarily it's going to tell them that it was a Chodesh Choser. They might think that there was just some unavoidable accident or something that prevented them from being able to do it. Which Tosfos points out then, so don't you have the same problem? What happens if there's a 30-day month and the second day of the Chodesh is Shabbos? Don't you have the same issue? The fact we don't do it for a mole at all. So the answer is, if you had every single month, we know that there were going to be masuas, and one month there weren't, they're more likely to think that it was oinus. But if we have, to begin with, the rule is set up that there are masuas only for a chodesh choser, not for a chodesh mole. So now, when they see that there's none on a particular motzei Shabbos, they're not going to think the itinusi, so they're not going to think the people got drunk on Shabbos, which was a less likely occurrence, they're more likely to attribute it to the fact that it was a Chodesh Mole. Okay, so the third possibility, why don't we do them for a Chodesh Mole and not for a Chodesh Choser? And then the advantage of that would be a kvius like this upcoming one. When Rosh Chodesh, after a Chodesh Choser, is on Friday, they're not going to do the Masuas, because again, it's Friday night and they can't. Automatically, they're gonna attribute it. They're not gonna attribute it the fact that that they don't have ones on Friday night. They're not gonna say it's because of shichus. They're gonna say obviously it's because it was a chodesh choser. So they're gonna automatically know, and then Motzei Shabbos will do it, and they'll know that it was a chodesh mole. So Amar Abaya Mishum Bito Malach La'Am Shnei Yamin. The reason we don't want to do that is because then always you're always gonna have 2 days. Every Rosh Hashanah, Rashi says, when the people are not going to be able to do malacha. Namely, what happens again? So you were asking a couple of minutes ago, Avraham Moshe, what happens? So does this mean they can't celebrate, they can never celebrate Rosh Chodesh in Chutz Lardes? The answer is what they would do is they would keep it as Rosh Chodesh to be on the safe side. And the truth is the 30th day they could keep as Rosh Chodesh regardless, because whether it's a 29-day month or whether it's a 30-day month, the 30th is always going to be Rosh Chodesh by definition. The Suffolk is on the 31st. So like this, what happens is, if we made the Masoris for Chodesh Malay, and again, we're not doing the Masoris until the night after Rosh Chodesh, the result is that everybody is going to have kept that 31st day to be on the safe side because they don't know whether it's Rosh Chodesh or Rosh Hashanah, rather, Rashi says, or not. So the result is every year they're going to have to stop Malacha on Rosh Hashanah for 2 days. They're going to have to not do Malacha on the 30th, fine, one way or the other, that is Rosh Hashanah. So at least if we do Masuris when it's a Chodesh Chaser, so what's going to happen then? So we have the 29th of Elul. That night, the moon was visible. So if that night, the moon was visible, and the next day is the one day Rosh Hashanah by Beis Din and everywhere else where Beis Din can send the signal to, including, we're saying, when they had these fires, they could send it as far as Babel. So fine, the night after the 30th, they're going to be sending the signals. Automatically, then everybody will know, okay, it was a Chodesh Chaser. There was only one day Rosh Hashanah. The next day, the 31st of Elul, which is now going to be the 2nd of Tishrei, is a regular work day and we can go to work. Whereas if we said that we're only going to send the signals for a Chodesh Malay, then what would happen? The night after the 29th, nothing, because that's too early to send anything. The night after the 30th, we would be saying we're not going to send yet because that's not when we do it. We would be doing it the night after the 31st. Well, then that means everybody had to keep both the 30th and the 31st as Yom Tov, not knowing whether there's going to be a signal that month or not. So therefore, we prefer to do it for a chaser, and that way at least they gain knowing that there's only one day Rosh Hashanah. So Rashi says that all of this is referring to only Rosh Hashanah. Tosfos says that actually it can refer to Rosh Chodesh as well. Every Rosh Chodesh, they used to have, the minhag used to be in the olden times that people didn't do work on Rosh Chodesh, or at least that they did less work on Rosh Chodesh. This is actually why we have that, we have four, when we learn Masechta Megillah, that's the Shem we're going to talk about, you have four aliyahs on Rosh Chodesh, whereas you have three on a regular weekday, because on Rosh Chodesh, you're still doing malacha, therefore we don't want to make the kriya too long, but we can make it a little bit longer because people are doing less work, just like Chol Hamoed. Tosfos also mentioned that in later times, the minhag developed that it's the women specifically that don't do malacha on Rosh Chodesh, which is a reward for them for not participating in the Egel. In fact, it's brought in some other places that the idea should have been, there would have been 12, there's 12 Rosh Chodeshim during the year. So each one would have been a Yom Tov for the Jewish people, and particularly each one Shevet would have it as their special Yom Tov, 12 Shvatim for 12 months of the year. Because of the Chet HaEgel, Hashem took it away from the men, but instead it stayed by the women, and they have the minhag not to do malacha on Rosh Chodesh. So according to Tosfos, then the same consideration that we're saying over here would apply every Rosh Chodesh. If we made the torches only after the Rosh Chodesh of a Chodesh Malay, then it would come out, everybody would have to cease work for 2 days, or at least everybody who keeps the minhag, whatever, would have to cease work for 2 days. Whereas at least like this, when we do it for a Chodesh Chaser, they're only having to cease work for 1 day.
How can you celebrate Rosh Chodesh?
Yeah.
How can you celebrate Rosh Chodesh without, at the time the Beis Hamikdash was Kayim, without the Edim? Al Pi Halacha, is that feasible?
1 second. Again, remember, the 30th of the previous month is going to have to be Rosh Chodesh regardless. One way or the other, you're going to keep it as Rosh Chodesh. If Edim come, then good. And if not, then you're keeping it Masafik because, maybe the Edim came, maybe not. Then the next day, so now you'd have the torches. So if it was a Chodesh Chaser, you have the torches. Now you know the next day is Beis of the month. It's the second of the month, the regular weekday, and they go to work. If not, then they know that it was a 30-day month, and today is Aleph, and today is Rosh Chodesh, therefore. Yeah, so they would be keeping Masafik the same way as we keep 2 days of Yom Tov Masafik. Okay, let's go on. We said in the Mishnah, Ketzed Hoyu Masi and Masois. So how do they do these torches? We said Mevi'in Kloinzeis V'chola, where they had long poles of cedar wood, and they tied various flammable materials to the end of it, and they lit them on fire. So since we're mentioning Kloinzeis Shel Erez, we're mentioning poles of cedar wood. So the Gemara says, Amar of Yehuda, Dalad Mine Arozenheim. There are four trees that are called Erez. In other words, the word Erez has a specific means a specific species, a cedar, but it also has a more general meaning certain kinds of trees that are in the cedar family. And they are Erez, Kasroin, Eitz Shemen, Ubroish. So most of those the Gemara understands without needing to translate them. Erez is a cedar tree. Eitz Shemen is a tree that produces a lot of oil. So it's a balsam tree or something. The Gemara is going to define it soon. And Broish, the Gemara is going to define soon as a boxwood tree, or some say a cypress. But Kasroim, the name Kasroim was not familiar to the later Amoraim, so they had to figure out what it means. So Kasroim, Omer Rav Adra. So Rav said that Kasroim is what we call in our language Adra. We learned in Masech the Beitza about that the Gemara said over there that if a person has nechosim, if a person has a field that he wants it to stay, that he wants it to have a permanence, yita bahen eder, he should plant an eder over there. And we had a couple of possibilities what an eder was. One explanation Rashi said over there, actually it was a kind of grass where it helps get rid of insects or whatever in your garden. But the other explanation based on our Gemara over here is that it was a type of tree. That's a tree that's called nowadays Spanish juniper. Right? So it's a big leafy, stately kind of tree. So therefore, the idea is, in other words, it serves like a landmark. Everybody knows that Pliny has an eder in his field, and therefore that helps if somebody tries to steal the field. Then everybody will know because everybody keeps track of such a thing. So that's one opinion of what Kasroim is this tree called Adro or eder. In the yeshiva of Rav Shila, they said that the meaning of Kasroim is a tree that's called an Aramaic Mavliga, but Amila is a Gulmish, and another opinion is that it's Gulmish. Both of those are types of trees. It's not clear what they are exactly. One thing is the Gemara in Sanhedrin mentions those two, Mavliga and Gulmish, as possibilities. When Hashem tells Noach to build the teva out of atse goifer, out of goifer wood. So the Gemara brings these two possibilities, Mavliga and Gulmish, as possibilities of what that wood was. So Bepashtus, it's some kind of light, strong wood. It could be balsa, it could be cypress, it could be whatever. Okay. So the Gemara says, now this that Rav Yehuda is saying that there are four kinds of eres, upliga de Rav Barav Huna. Now that disagrees with what Rav Barav Huna says. They said in the yeshiva of Rav, Asara mine arozim. There are 10 kinds of trees that are in the cedar family, not just four. Which Tosfos says, okay, you could say, in other words, that the machloikus could be as far as mekach or memker. If I'm selling you a tree, if I tell you I'm selling you an erez tree, and it turns out to be one of these types, then you don't have a claim that it was a mekach tos because it's included in the cedar family. But they might agree. For other purposes, we do count 10 types of arozim. In fact, Tosfos says the Yoshami lists 24 types. So there are 10 kinds. Shenemar, so in the Yeshiva of Rab, they related that to a posuk in Yeshaya. The Navi is describing how you're going to have people that are wandering through the desert to make it back to Eretz Yisrael by the Gula Mitzvah Shleima. And Hashem promises that he's going to make the way easy for them. Hashem says, Etin b'midbar erez shita v'hadas v'etz shemen. I will place in the midbar, I'll make grow in the midbar these kinds of trees, which are going to define them one by one. Erez shita hadas v'etz shemen. So far that's four. Osim ba'arova, I will place in the deserted areas. Arova also means like not the desert per se, but also like deserted areas. Broish tidos, asho yachtav, the brush, the tidor, and the ta'asho together. So you have 7 kinds, and the Gemara is going to say soon that we have to add another 3. So let's first define what the 7 that I mentioned in the pasuk are. Erez is arza, is a cedar tree. Shita is turnisa, a pine tree. Hadas is osa, a hadas tree. Eitz shemen is a farsama, a balsam tree. Brush is brata, brush is a boxwood tree. Tidhar is shoga. Tidhar is a fir tree. And ta'ashur, shurivna. And ta'ashur is a shurivna tree. Unlike all the other ones, it actually doesn't give a translation of shurivna. So there's a couple of possibilities that have been brought up. It might be an ebony tree, which is a tree with extremely hard, dark wood that grows in the tropics. It might be a cypress tree. There's a couple of possibilities about that last one, shurivna. Anyway, so those are seven. So the Gemara says, Hani Shiva Habu. Now that's only seven. What are the other three? So Ki Osir Rav Dimi Omar, when Rav Dimi came from Eretz Yisrael, he said, Hosif Walehem, we also have to add to them Aloinim, Almonim, Almugim. We also have to add those three trees to, and then we have our list of 10 kinds of Erez. What are those in Aramaic? Aloinim is Butmi, is elm trees. Almonim is baluti. The word almonim refers to oak trees. And almogin is kasisa. Almogin is coral. Now, coral is not a tree. Actually, it grows. It grows on the seafloor. It's built up by little creatures, by little coral creatures it's essentially formed from their skeletons. You have many different kinds of coral, but in particular, you have ones that branch and resemble trees. And in halacha, the Gemara considers it to be a tree. Even in halacha, for example, you have usually the rule is that things that come from fish or from other marine life are not makabel tuma. For example, you take fish bones or fish skins or what have you and make a keli out of it. That keli is not makabel tuma. But coral is not like that. Coral is considered to be a tree, la halacha, and if you make something out of coral, it is makabel tuma. So that's counted as the 10th type of erez. The Gemara says ikadami, another version is that the last three are aroinim, armonim, almugim. So again, let's define them. Aroinim is eri, is laurel trees. Armonim is dulvi. Rashi translates dulvi as chestnut trees, although Tosfos argues on the basis of a Gemara and Sukkah that a chestnut tree, the leaves of it don't grow in the pattern that the Gemara describes over there. So Tosfos says it must be something else. Yesh omim, that it's what's called in English a plane tree. Anyway, and almogim, kasisa, either way, the third one is almogim, which again is coral. So either way, we have our list of 10 arozim. Okay, since we're talking about coral, so now we have to consider, how do they harvest coral? It grows on the seabed. It's not that easy to pull up. It's very tightly attached. The Gemara is going to describe now the process by which they would harvest coral. Starting with a pasuk in Yeshaya, it says, "V'tzi adir lo yavrenu," a mighty ship will not be able to pass it. The context it's talking about is that l'osid lovay, a stream is going to flow out of the Beis Mikdash. We learned about that stream in Masechta Yuma, that it's going to start out tiny and then it becomes larger and larger as it goes. Eventually, it runs through Eretz Yisrael. It goes, one branch of it goes to the Mediterranean, another branch goes to the Dead Sea, and the water of it sweetens them so that now, instead of being salt water, now those will be fresh water, and then people will be able to drink from them, and more kinds of fish and marine life will be able to live in them, especially the Dead Sea is so salty. Nothing lives in it nowadays. Anyway, so the main description of that river is in Sefer Yechezkel. But in Yeshaya, he refers to it also, and he says it's going to be such a mighty river that si adir lo yavrenu, that even a tremendously large ship will not be able to cross that river. So what do we mean? What kind of big ship are we talking about? Amar Rav zubuni gdoila. So Rav says we're referring to the kind of large ship that was called in his time the buni gdoila. Buni means a large ship that's propelled by oars. Such a ship is not going to be able to pass cross the stream that comes out of the Beis Mikdash. But now we're also going to talk about that they use this kind of ship for harvesting coral. So the Gemara says, Hechi Abu, how did they do it? What was the process? Maisu shis alpha gabri betresi yarche shata. They would get 6,000 workers working for 12 months of the year. Ba'amila tresi alpha gabri beshita yarche shata. Or some say it was the other way around, 12,000 men in six months. So one way or the other, in other words, you had the same amount of man hours, but how it was distributed, two different opinions how it was distributed. The Maharal refers in Chiddush HaGadol that we're not necessarily just talking the simple sense of things. We're talking about that there would be a reason according to each opinion why the Dafka needed to distribute the hours in this way. Whatever the case, they had that many people working for that amount of time. The Tani Lachola, what they would do is they would take this big ship and fill it up with sand ad the Shachna until the sand makes it sink. and the bottom of the boat now sinks down to the seabed. Meanwhile, the boat is large enough that the top of it is still above the waterline, but the bottom of it is now the bottom of it is now on the ground, is now on the seabed. Then v'noches bar amiroi, then a diver would go down, v'kotar aktuni dekitna b'kasisa, he would tie bundles of linen. So Rashi says the point is linen is very tough. It doesn't snap that easily. So he'd take one end of the bundle and tie it b'kasisa to the coral that they want to extract. V'kotar lehu b'sfinta, then he ties the other end of the linen of the flax to the boat. So now the Napli Chala, now workers go above the waterline where the top of the boat is still above the waterline. They start taking the sand out of the boat. The Shodu Levroi, they start throwing it off the boat. The Kamadimida, so now the boat is getting lighter and lighter. Eventually it's going to lift off the seabed and back to its normal position. The Kama de Medallia, as the boat starts going up, because the burden on it is lighter, Okra or Masya, then it pulls along the coral, which is attached with these linen ropes or flax bundles or whatever, is attached to the coral. So therefore, when the ship refloats, then it pulls up the coral with it. In other words, the point is the coral would have been too difficult. The coral would have been too difficult for them to cut or to pull out of the ground over there in the seabed in the normal way. Therefore, they needed this whole elaborate method in order to be able to use the bulk and the weight of the ship itself to be able to pull it out. And it was so expensive, the coral, or machlef al chad shein b'kaspa, when they sold it, they could sell it for twice its weight in silver. That's how much it was. That's how valuable it was. But Pashtos also, since it took so much effort to harvest it, then that raised the price, because you got to factor into the price the amount, the amount, the salaries of the workers, etc. Yeah. So the Gemara tells. In one sense, the Gemara is telling us an actual method that they used over here. But in Yaakov, one of the Mephoshim on Ein Yaakov points out that also the sand represents the Jewish people, as it does in various Mishalim in the Gemara, and therefore that filling it up with sand and emptying it out represents how even the Jewish people are thrown around from one place to another. Nevertheless, what we get out of it is something precious. We still have the precious Torah with us, which is even more precious than silver, like the coral we're saying over here.
Can you say it, how the people are able to stay in the water?
So the divers, that's the thing. I guess the divers didn't take that long. It takes them only a couple of minutes to tie one end to the coral and another. Then maybe they surface in between and then they tie the other end to the boat. It doesn't take them that long necessarily. No, the taking out the sand is above the waterline. That's the thing. Oh. Keep in mind, only the bottom part of the boat is underwater. The top part, that's what we were saying before. It's a very large boat. Such that, let's say, for example, you have, let's say, in the place where the coral grows, let's say the seabed is 30 feet down. Fine. So they build a boat that's 40 feet tall, and that's 40 feet tall from keel to from keel to gunwales. And that way, even when the bottom 30 feet of it are in the water, you still have 10 feet of it above water. Yeah. So the Gemara tells plus parvosa havyan. Now in this area where they harvested the coral, there were three ports. Tarte be armoi v'chodah de be parsoi. Two belong to the Romans, one of them belonged to the Persians. De be armoi maskan kasisa. So the Romans used to harvest coral from their two ports. They would do this whole procedure that we said with the giant boat and the ropes and all of that. And they would harvest coral from there and they would sell it for high prices. De be parsoi maskan marganaisa. The Persians in their port, they didn't bother with coral. Instead, they harvested pearls. They would have divers go down from this port and harvest pearls from the bottom of the sea. Or Mikaria Parvosa de Mashmehig, they called this place the port of Mashmehig, where Mashmehig is a Persian word that means the royal. So it means the royal port. Because they harvested pearls for it, that would be they would go to the king's crown jewels, and then I guess they'd sell whatever they didn't need, and then get more money for the king's treasury. Ben Yehoyada points out there is a place, Ado Yemezeh, in the Persian Gulf, where they have pearl fisheries in the area around the country of Bahrain. So he says maybe that's the Parvosa de Mashmehig of our Gemara over here. Okay. So the Gemara says, Amar Rav Yechanan. So that's that. So that's the description of how they would harvest this coral. So the point is, though, again, we're saying lahalacha coral is considered a tree, even though it's not, even though botanically it's not, it grows from little organisms under the water, and this is how they would harvest it. You find, for example, in Sefer Melachim and in Divrei Hayamim, it tells how when Malkas Shiva came to visit Shlomo, she brought with her Atzei Almugim, which we're saying over here is this coral, and Shlomo used it for various decorative purposes in the Beis Mikdash. Because it was very rare, it was something very rare and expensive. Like we're saying over here, it's worth twice its weight in silver. And then and Shlomo wasn't going to use it to beautify his own palace, he used it to beautify the Beis Mikdash. So in this connection, we mentioned before the Pasuk Etid Mamidbar Eretz Shita. So the Gemara says more Durashas on it. Amar Rav Yechanan, kol shita v'shita should not nochrim Mirshalayim. Every shita tree, every wooden beam that the goyim took away from Yerushalayim, which we're mentioning shita because in particular that's used for buildings. Like you have the Mishkan was made out of atzei shita. So every beam that the goyim took from Yerushalayim, asid HaKadosh Baruch Hu lachziron la, in the future Hashem will restore them to Yerushalayim. Shenem etin mamidbar eres shita, as we have the pasuk that we quoted before, Hashem says, I'll place Erez and Shita in the Midbar. And what does Midbar mean? Ve'en Midbar, El Yerushalayim. The word Midbar, we can also darshan, means only Yerushalayim. Shenema, Tzion, Midbar HaYosef, as you have a pasuk where the Navi is bemoaning the Churban, and he says, Tzion has become a desert. Yerushalayim Shmama, the pasuk continues. Hagoy Sabah brings the rest of the pasuk. So we see, therefore, that Hashem is also saying that that what's now a Midbar, Yerushalayim, will be re-beautified with the Shita, with the beams of Shita wood that used to be there. Marsha points out the reason is because if it just meant that Hashem is going to plant them in the Midbar, the word would have been Eta, I will plant them. Etain suggests like I will give something that used to be there. The Amar of Yechanan, also of Yechanan says in this connection, Kola loymed Torah v'enem alamda, anybody who learns Torah but doesn't teach it to others, doymer lahadas b'midbar, he's like a hadas tree in the desert. You can't get anything out of it. It's in there, in the middle of the desert. Nobody gets to it. So therefore, in other words, it's like it's wasted. He has, we know, when it comes to the Dalad Minim, right, the hadas represents the one, okay, usually we talk about the hadas represents the one who has a lot of mitzvahs because of the fragrance of it. But still, in our Gemara, we're using instead the fragrance as a metaphor for Torah. So therefore, so he's like a hadas in the Midbar where nobody benefits from it. Ikadamri, another version of what Rabbi Yechanan said, was the other way around, the positive thing. Somebody who learns Torah and teaches it in a place where there are no other Talmid Chachamim, then he's like a hadas in the desert, which is very precious. Anybody who comes across it in the desert is very eager to see it and to take a piece of it and whatever. And the same way, he being in a ruchniistic desert and teaching Torah, he's like a hadas that everybody who comes through benefits from it. Like the Shulchan, yeah. That's very, very appropriate now during the Kinnas HaShulchan, yeah. And V'Amar Rav Yechanan, Rav Yechanan says, here's another thing we learn in connection with this, that we said that Hashem is going to restore everything that was taken away from Yerushalayim. Oylehem la'odik achavim she'em lehem takana. Woe to the goyim, to the nations of the world, they should realize they have no way of fixing up what they did. Shenema, you have a pasuk in Yeshaya, tachas anachoshes avizav, Hashem promises la'osid lavoi, instead of the copper that was stolen from the Jewish people, I will bring gold, meaning that Hashem is going to make the goyim bring gold to compensate for the copper that they stole from the Jewish people. Al derech, like you have, for example, when you take from Hekdesh or from Truma or whatever, where you have to pay back keren v'choymesh, in a similar vein, they're going to be made to pay back more than what they stole. The tachas abarzel ovi kesef, instead of the iron that they stole, I'm going to make them bring silver. The sachas ha'etzim nechoshes, and instead of the wood they stole, they're going to have to bring copper. The sachas ha'avonim barzel, and instead of the stones, they're going to bring iron. So each thing, they're going to bring something more valuable. But Rabbi Yechanan says, think of, there's not just gashmiistic of things they stole. Tachas Rabbi Akiva v'chaverav ma'imavim. What could they possibly bring to make up for Rabbi Akiva v'chaverav, who they killed and they robbed from us? And the answer is they can't. That's what he means. There's nothing they can ever do to fix up that. On that, the pasuk says, "Vinikasi." We would say it in every Shabbos in Avad Achman. "Vinikasi." Hashem says, even if I'm going to cleanse them for their other averas, "Damam loy nikasi," but for their blood, for the blood of Rabbi Akiva v'Chaveira and other Talmid Chachamim that they spilled, "Loy nikasi," I will not clean them up because they have nothing. There's nothing of greater value, or even of equal value, that they can bring to restore to make up for what they took away. Even Marshall says, you could say that they themselves are going to die for it. So what? What's their life worth compared to the life of Rabbi Akiva v'Chaveira? An interesting point, Chassam Sofer says, he brings from the Arizal and from other earlier people than him, that why are we davka davshin in this regarding Rabbi Akiva? Because the pasuk right before that in Yeshaya ends with the words Avir Yaakov, which means the mighty one of Yaakov, which means Hashem. The words Avir Yaakov can be rearranged to spell Rabbi Akiva. And therefore, that's what makes the Gemara, that's what leads the Gemara here to Darshan, that was saying that even if they can replace all the Nechoshes and Barizal and so on and so forth, but Rabbi Akiva v'Chaveira, they can never replace.
According to this, Hashem is going to make them alive.
Apparently the idea is Hashem will bring them alive so that they can be forced to pay off what they need to, and then they'll get their punishment, yeah. The Gemara says, "Umeayin hoy masiyin masuris chulam base built in." So then the Mishnah had gone on to list the actual places where they would do the signal fires from Haramishcha to Sartava, from Sartava to Rufina, etc. And they wind up in base built in. So my base built in. What's that place called nowadays? Omerav Zubiram. This refers to a city called Biram, which was on the border between Eretz Yisrael and Babel. My goyla, so we said that the person there in base built in would be waving his torch up and down and back and forth until he sees the goyla in front of him like a fire. So my goyla, what do we mean the goyla? Obviously, it can't mean the entire bubble. You can't see the entire bubble from one vantage point. Rabbi Yosef Zu Pumbedisa. That refers specifically to the city of Pumbedisa, which was the center of Jewish life in Babel. So therefore, so he'd see that he could see from base built in. They were close enough. Derisor showed him as an interesting point about that. He says, really, what it is it used to be that Nahodah was the center of Jewish life in Babel. But Nahodah was destroyed by an invading army early in the time of the Amoraim, a few years after Shmuel passed away, and the yeshiva that used to be in Nahodah, Shmuel's yeshiva, moved to Pumbedisa. So afterwards, they thought of Pumbedisa as the second Nahodah. So like when Rabbi Yosef, a few generations later, was referring to Pumbedisa. He means, in other words, back in the earlier times, it would have actually been the physical city of Nahodah. But we're thinking of Pumbedisa nowadays as like the new Nahodah. So Mike Medura Seish, what do we mean that he saw it like a big fire? Tana, so we learn in a braisa, Kol Echad V'Echad Noitel Avuka V'Yodei, when they saw the signal fire from base built in, from Biram, every person in Pumbedisa or Nahodah or whatever would take a torch in his hand and go up onto his roof and hold it there in that way. So from base built in, from a distance, it looked like one big fire. And then obviously it meant that they received the message, and then they would go and transmit it to all the other cities in Babel. Tanya. Now we learn in a braise that Reb Shimon Elazar Omer afchorim v'kayir v'goder v'chavrei seho. Also, they had signal fires on these places, Chorim, Kair, and Gader, and other nearby mountains. I guess Agrah brings a different gear set that it's supposed to be Chore Michvar v'Gader, where Michvar is a range of mountains in Eivra Yarden and what's nowadays Jordan. Whatever. So what does that mean? So why, when Shimon Elazar is adding that list, Ika de Amri Beni or Beni Habukaimi, some say that those were between the mountains that we mentioned in the Mishnah. In other words, let's say, for example, it might be too far between, let's say, for example, between Haramishcha and Sartava, it might be too far for them to be able to see the fire from one to the other. So in between, they had other places that Rav Shimon Elazar is telling us that are not mentioned in the Mishnah, because the Mishnah is only mentioning like the big ones. Another possibility is that Rav Shimon Elazar is talking about mountains that were on the other side of Eretz Yisrael. So in other words, Mar Choshev Dehai Gisa, Mar Choshev Dehai Gisa. So the list in our Mishnah is along one side of Eretz Yisrael, let's say the east side, and Rav Shimon Elazar's list would be, let's say, along the west side. So that way, in other words, there'd be two routes in parallel that are going towards Babel. The pashtus in order to inform different other Jewish communities on the way. Omer Rabbi Yechonon, Bein Kol Achas V'Achas Shmoina Parsois. Rabbi Yochanan says between each one of these stations that are listed in the Mishnah, there's eight parsa. A parsa is about 2.5 or 3 miles, so you're talking eight parsa is about 20 miles, give or take. So between each one, there's about 20 miles from one mountain to the next. Yeah. So the Gemara says, Kama Havaluhu. Well, how much does that add up to? In the Mishnah, we had five stations listed. That means there are four spaces between them. That means that it comes out, Tlosin Vatautin, it comes out to 32 parsa, which is something around 80 or 90 miles, right? So what do you mean? It's only 80 or 90 miles from Yerushalayim, from Har HaMishka, all the way to Beis Biltin, which is on the border of Bavel. Nowadays, it's a much greater distance. The Abaya says the answer is that the roads have gotten closed off. That used to be that you could go on a straight line, and when you're seeing a signal fire, you can still see it in a straight line. But nowadays, with traveling, you have to go on roundabout ways. As you have, Hashem warns the Jewish people through the Navi Hosea. I'm going to stop up your way with thorns. So nowadays, like the roads are blocked off with thorns, and it means also metaphorical thorns, like the Romans that would interfere with Kiddush HaChodesh, and therefore we have to go the long way around. Rav Nachman Yitzchok learns the same concept from a different pasuk in Eicha, where the Navi complains, he made my paths crooked. Same idea. In other words, they can't go on a straight line anymore. They have to go the long way around. Tosfos still wonders that it seems to come out that from other Gemaras that still you have, even when the Beis Hamikdash was standing, you still had a much longer route to go from Yerushalayim to Bavel, certainly much more than 32 parsa. So actually, if you look on a map, It's not so clear where Pubadissa or Nahadah were, but they're definitely someplace in Iraq. If you measure even on a straight line on a map, you get from your Shalayim to there, it's a good 400 or 500 miles. So Bapashtus, then again, like we said before, there were other mountains in between. And the other possibility is you have the famous thing that it says that when the Jewish people are in Eretz Yisrael, then it expands, and when they're not, then it shrinks. So also, you know, it might be variable at different times. It might also be, you know, that after all, the border of Eretz Yisrael is Nahar Pras. Well, in that case, Nahar Dor and Pubadissa are right there on Nahar Pras as well. So if you look at it that way, then fine, it's a large distance from Yerushalayim, but ultimately from the border of Eretz Yisrael to the border of Bavel is really not necessarily that far. Mishnah says, by the way, the Medrash also mentions such things in connection with this pasuk Misivoy Seiva. The Medrash mentions, for example, that there used to be when the Beis Hamikdash was standing, that a lady in Lod, for example, and we know nowadays, I mean, you know, the airports in Lod, we know how long it takes to get from there to Yerushalayim. So a woman in that area could set up a batch of dough, run to the Beis Hamikdash to daven, come back, and the dough is still not chametz yet. That's how direct the roads were in those times, as opposed to now, when you have curvy roads and traffic jams and what have you. Horses and wagons, yeah. It's still only that fast they could go.
Now it's 45 minutes. Yeah,
an hour like that. Okay, Mishnah says. Chotzer gdoila ha'isib Yerushalayim. There was a big chotzer in Yerushalayim. Or Beis Yazik, ha'isib Nikris. The name of the place was Beis Yazik. Or the Shom kol ha'edim miskansin. All the edim who came to testify about Edus HaChodesh would all gather over there. Or based in Bodkin, some shaman based in would cross examine them there in that chotzer, or maybe in some outbuilding or some little chotzer nearby there. Tosfos points out that maybe they didn't stay in the chotzer itself. There's maybe like little other mavoyas and chatzeres and whatever that open into it. Like maybe, you know, based in is not necessarily cross examining them in front of all the other edim. After all, you want to make sure that everybody's saying the truth. So they would take them like into a side area or whatever. They used to make in this base Yazik, they would make big sudas for them so that they should be in the habit of coming. Because like this, you don't want you want that whenever they see the moon, they should come. So therefore you want to give them an incentive. So the big sudas were meant as an incentive. But now originally if they came on Shabbos. So we said they're able to be mechalal Shabbos to come even from outside the tchum. But originally, if they came from outside the tchum, they would not move from that chotzer the entire day because they had gone outside the tchum. And we learn in Masechta Eruvin that if a person goes outside the tchum on Shabbos, then in the new place where he is, he only has 4 amas. So the whole chotzer can be counted as 4 amas, but nevertheless, they couldn't go outside of that chotzer. Tosfos points out that why couldn't they at least walk in the whole city of Yerushalayim? The city has a wall around it. The answer is there were times in history when there were breaches in the walls, when the Yevonim, for example, made breaches in the walls. So during times like that, Yerushalayim is no longer considered a walled city. You're not even allowed to carry it in on Shabbos, for example. So by the same token, then it couldn't count as 4 amas regarding them walking. So apparently these breaches were wider than 10 amas. Yeah. Anyway. So Hiskin Ram Gamliel Azokin, however, Ram Gamliel Azokin made a takana that it's not like that. They will be able to walk further, that they can walk 2,000 amas in every direction. In other words, in effect, what we consider is as though Yerushalayim was where they began, Shabbos, and therefore they're like all the other people of Yerushalayim. They can walk throughout the city and 2,000 amas outside of it. V'loy elu bilvad, not only this case of Edei HaChodesh is that rule applied, el af chachama habal yalid, also a midwife who comes from out of town to help a woman give birth, v'habal ha'chulman adleika, or somebody who comes to save other Jews from a fire, or min ha'gayis, or from a marauding band of bandits, or min ha'nahar, or from a river that flooded, or min ha'mapolis, or from a building that collapsed, such people are considered like the people of the town. They also can walk 2,000 amas in every direction outside the city. In other words, the Chachamim considered it that it's as if they began Shabbos in that city. Based on this, actually, an interesting point. There's a Truva of Rav Moshe where he talks about Hatzolah members. If they go on a Hatzolah call on Shabbos, so obviously to go on the call, they can do that because the Koach Nefesh. Are they allowed afterwards to return with their ambulance or with their vehicle or whatever? He says, yes, if there's no goy available to bring them back, then yes, they are, based on our Mishnah and based on relevant Gemaras in Eruvin and other places that discuss such points. Because again, the idea is that first of all, you want to encourage them to do it in the future. If they figure they're going to be stuck there the whole Shabbos, they may not want to in the first place. And also there's the point this way, they're available for the next call, et cetera. Yeah. Reb Shlomo Zalman, mind you, disagreed with a good deal of that. So halacha l'maisa, I guess each local hatzolah chapter has to ask a rav what to do. But yeah. Okay, so when they have, so if they're able to hire goyim, even Reb Moshe would agree that's the right way to do it. Yeah. Okay. So the Gemara asks, Iboilahu, base Yaazek Tnan or base Yaazek Tnan? What's the name of the place in our mission? Is it base Yaazek with an ayin or base Yaazek without an ayin? What does that mean? Base Yaazek Tnan, if it's with an ayin, Lishna Mal Yehu, then it's a name that shows about the niceness of the place. It's a complimentary name. You have a pasuk that gives a long mashal where Hashem describes how he planted a vineyard representing the Jewish people, and vayazkehu, he surrounded it with a stone wall, vayisaklehu, and he removed all the stones from the dirt over there so that the soil would be the best quality. So therefore, vayazkehu means to surround something with a stone wall, and therefore it was called Beis Yaazek because surrounded with a beautiful stone wall. So is it that, or do a base Yaazek Tnan, or maybe it's base Yaazek without an ayin, lishna tzarahu, in which case it's a lishna tzar, who also boziki, as you have a pasuk about Yirmiyah after the Churban, where he's chained up, he's tied up in chains. And in that case, they would have called it base Yaazek without the ayin to represent the fact that they're chained up there on Torah, Gamliel, Azok, and Sakana, they're stuck there for the whole Shabbos. So what was it? We said in the mission that would make them big sudas, showing that they didn't have tzar. But Moses says, okay, that doesn't prove anything. Maybe it was both. There was the tzar that they can't leave the place on Shabbos until Ram Gamliel Azok and Takana. And there's also, on the other hand, they have the pleasure of a nice suda. So no proof one way or the other. Tosfos actually learns that the question and the answer is not so much that they can't go out of there on Shabbos, but was it a big, wide place where they have plenty of room to move around, or was it a narrow place? And therefore, Abaye is trying to prove from the fact that they had Sudas Gdolas, obviously it must have been a very big place for them to be able to have room for a Sudas Gdola. Okay, so no clear proof one way or the other then. Mishnah says, Ketzad Boidkinos Eidim, how would they cross-examine the Eidim? Zug Shaborishin Boidkinos Eidim, whichever pair of Eidim came first is the first one they would interrogate. Or Machnissin as a Gadol Shebehen, within that pair of Eidim, they would first bring in the Gadol. The Pashtus, usually the Gadol would be the eldest one. I guess if there was one with a Talmud Chacham and one was not, then they'd bring in the Talmud Chacham first, whatever. But Omrim Loyan, they ask him, Emer, tell us, Ketzad Re'isa Salavana, how did you see the moon? And they ask him a bunch of details. Lifnei Hachama or La'achar Hachama? Did you see it before the sun or behind the sun? Now, we're going to the Gemara is going to assume, and Rashi has a long explanation about what this assumption is, that it means like this: the at the beginning of the month, shortly after the Molad, the moon is near the sun. It sets a very short time after the sun does. Now, how does the sun move? The sun and the moon both move in a path through the sky. They rise in the east. They travel towards the south side of the sky. So during the winter, it's lower in the sky. During the summer, it's higher in the sky. But always in the northern hemisphere, it's always on the southern. It's always on the south side. So yeah, it goes from east. It goes in an angle around to the south, and then it sets in the west. So during the winter time, it rises closer to the southeast, and it goes fairly low in the sky and sets in the southwest. During the summertime, it rises in the northeast and goes a much longer path through the sky and goes much higher, almost until the zenith, and almost until the highest point in the sky from your vantage point, and then it sets. But it always goes from east to west. And it always, that path in the northern hemisphere always goes by way of the south. In the southern hemisphere, it wouldn't, but the Gemara, of course, is written in the northern hemisphere. So therefore, the vote would be, on the face of it, Lifnei Hachama and La'achar Hachama would be, in other words, is the moon ahead of the sun in the sense that it's further toward the north? So in other words, the sun has gone on this path, going by way of the south and then setting in the west, and the moon is already ahead of it and is already before it, or is the moon behind it, meaning that it's still a little further south of the sun? So which the Gemara is going to ask that doesn't fit with the words of the Mishnah, and it's going to give a different explanation. So we ask him, Lifnei Hachama or La'achar Hachama, was it before the sun or behind it? L'tzfoina or L'droima, was it north of the sun or south of it? So now that's what the Gemara is going to ask. In that case, if we define Lifnei and La'achar the way we just did, then it comes out the same as north or south of it. So we're going to see in the Gemara. Kamahoya Gavoya, how high off the ground was it? He could express it in terms of degrees or in terms of buildings that he sees or whatever, or trees or whatever. Which direction were the horns of the crescent pointing? We know how sometimes the moon will look like that. Sometimes it'll look like this, straight up and down. Sometimes it's like this. Sometimes it's tilted one way or the other. So they'll ask them, which way was it tilted? And how wide was the crescent? And the Mishnah tells us one example. Im Amar Lifnei Hachama. If he said that he saw it Lifnei Hachama, Lo Yomar Klum. Then what he said is worthless, and we throw out that ages. The other ones it can be. Sometimes it can be the Tzfoina, sometimes the Drayma, sometimes it can be narrow, sometimes wide, etc. But that one question was just to weed out like people who don't even know what they're talking about. Then they would bring in the second aid from the pair and interrogate him. If what they're saying matches Eidos and Kayemas, then their Eidos is valid and they can be Mekadosh the Chodesh based on that. Now, meanwhile, they have many other Eidim waiting over there. As far as all the other pairs, they don't really need them at this point anymore. They ask them the basic things. They don't get into all the details that we said here in the Mishnah, but at least they ask them some basic points. Not because they really need them. At this point, they already have the first aiders. So they don't leave disappointed. Again, we want them to be accustomed to coming. We don't want in the future, they're going to say, why should I bother? Last time, they didn't even listen to me. And next time, that pair might be the only ones who see the moon. So that we just said they made parties for them, but Rashi, by the way, defines the ayin hoy nota not just which way it tilted, but also you can see the little diagrams here in Rashi using almost like emojis. Is it pointing to the north or is it pointing toward the south? Like, does the crescent look like this or does it look like this? Yeah, he uses the hammer, really. Yeah, right there. Yeah. Little tiny diagrams and that. Yeah. So the Gemara asks, "Heinu lifnei acham, heinu l'tzfoina, heinu l'acha, acham, heinu l'drema." Based on the way we just defined it before, lifnei acham sounds like the same as the north of the sun. In other words, that again, the sun has set and the moon is ahead of it. The moon is further down in the sky than the sun. Maybe the sun has not set yet. The moon is further down in the sky than the sun, which means it's heading towards the north. Because again, if during the daytime it heads towards the south, then during the nighttime it's heading towards the north underground. And Hainu L'Achar Achama, Hainu L'Drema. And L'Achar Achama would be defined as south of the sun. So why are they repeating the question? Amar Abaya says, no, the first question, Lifnei and L'Achar, was P'imasa Lifnei Achama, L'Achar Achama. They're asking the empty side, the dark side of the moon, was it facing towards the sun or was it facing away from the sun? And therefore, if he says, so if he says that it was in front of the sun, in other words, that the concave side is facing towards the sun. In other words, if they're saying, here is the sun, here is the moon, and the crescent, the inside of the crescent is facing towards the sun, then what he said doesn't count for anything. Because how does the moon get its light? It gets its light from the sun. Necessarily, the lit side is always going to be facing the sun. So in other words, it's going to be like this. If this is the sun and this is the moon, then the lit side of the moon is always going to have to be facing the sun. De'amar Rabbi Yechanan, as Rabbi Yechanan says, "My dichtiv hamshav afachad imay oisah shalom imrayim." Well, the pasuk says there's dominion and fear with him, with Hashem. He makes peace in his heavens. So what does that mean? The sun has never seen the concave side of the moon, but like, and also not the concave side of the rainbow. When you see a rainbow in the sky, the curve of it, the outside curve of it, is always facing towards the sun, never the other way around. You never have that the rainbow appears upside down, such that the inside of it would be facing towards the sun. So why? Pigimasa shall Lavana. We never have the sun is going to see the Pigima of Lavana, the Chol Shadaita. Because that would make the moon feel bad. We know the famous thing that originally the moon was complete like the sun, and then it complained, and Hashem told the Lachiyu Mati Asatmi. So therefore, we don't ever want. So therefore, Hashem arranged it that the moon's dark side is never going to be facing the sun. And Pigimasa shall Keshis. Why do we have the rainbow is the shape the way it is? We don't want that. Hashem didn't want that people who worship the sun are going to claim that the rainbow is actually the sun shooting arrows at people who don't want to worship it. Which way do you hold a bow when you're shooting a bow and arrow? You hold it with the open side facing you. So therefore, if the rainbow was shaped like that, it would look like people who worship the sun could claim that the sun is using the rainbow to shoot arrows at people who don't believe in its divinity. So like this, Hashem made it the other way around. So therefore, Samar Shah says that Hamsha Wafahad Imoy refers to that second part, that Hashem makes it, that he shows that he's the boss, not the sun. And the first part, Oitzah Shalom Imraimov, refers to the Shalom that's created by the moon, not by the sun not seeing the dark side of the moon. Tosfos points out, now what about sometimes you have the moon might be on the same side as the hollow side of the Keshet. That's not a big deal because usually you only see a rainbow by day. So by night, and by day, even if the moon happens to be in the sky, it's so dim compared to the sun. It's like a candle, and it's like a candle relative to the sunlight, and therefore nobody's going to think that it's the moon has power and is using the rainbow for its purposes. So you could sometimes have the moon might be visible within a rainbow, and that doesn't matter. Everyone.